We ended last time. Well, let me start by making the following just general statement. As you all know, I've been for the last 6 months, right, I've been enrolled in a tour guide course, which I'm doing for a number of reasons, also for professional reasons, but also for my own general broadening of the mind in many ways. And it certainly is opening my mind to many, many things on many, many different levels. But it happens to be that in today's shiur, I came across a number of different aspects of things, including something that came up just yesterday on a siur that I was in Masada that I will discuss with you, Bezrat Hashem, in a few minutes. We left off last time, and I'd like to begin again this time at the very beginning of Perek Tet, chapter 9. Remember, we talked last time about the structure of the chapters that discuss Shlomo. I won't go through that again, but the idea that the Beit HaMikdash is sort of wedged in there right in the center between two sections, which describe Shlomo's secular projects, or apparently secular projects, his military and economic and political activities. The first section we've already learned, and we're going to be looking today at the second of those two sections. In the middle, sandwiched in between those two, is the discussion of the Beit HaMikdash, but within that is the description of some of the other non-sacred buildings that Shlomo built as what seems to be part of the same complex in Yerushalayim, particularly his own palace and that very unusual and enigmatic structure called Beit Yahar HaLevanon, whatever that is. And we saw at the very end last time, we looked at Shlomo's tefillah that he said at the dedication of the Beit HaMikdash. And then Perek Tet began the following, with the second of the two revelations that Shlomo received from God. Twice, Shlomo became a prophet. Like many kings, he had prophets who were sent to deliver messages to him directly from God. But twice in his life, Shlomo himself became a prophet and had a direct revelation from God. The first time was in Gibeon, shortly after becoming king, we saw that he went to Gibeon, where the Mishkan was at that time, and offered many, many sacrifices. And God came to him at night and said, you know, I'm so impressed with you, ask whatever you want and you can have it. And Shlomo asked for wisdom. And then God said, well, you didn't ask for wealth and power and honor. I'm going to give you all that, and I'll give you wisdom. And now it's the second one. But I just want to, and we'll read it just again, and let's just see how it's introduced here. By he, Kechalot Shlomo livnot et Beit Adonai ve'et Beit HaMelech ve'et kol cheshek Shlomo asher chafetz la'asot. The timing of this second revelation is when he finished building his house and the palace, which means that we can come up with a fairly exact date for this revelation. Why do I say that? Well, you will recall that he began building the Beit HaMikdash. First of all, he ruled for a total of 40 years, we're going to see, as his father David also ruled for 40 years. 40 years, Arbaim. In the fourth year of his reign, he began to build the Beit HaMikdash. And we're told that that took 7 years. And then he began to build his palace and the other structures, and that took 13 years. And we talked last time about what the significance is of the fact that he spent more time building his own palace, though. Could be understood in more than one way. But in any case, those two building projects together, the Beit HaMikdash and all of the surroundings, and then the Beit HaMelech and all of the surroundings, take 20 years, 7 and 13, which means that we're now 24 years into Shlomo's 40-year reign, approximately just a little more than halfway through his career as king, if you want to call it that. And it's also interesting the way the Tanakh describes it. Kechalot Shlomo, when he completed Livnot, building Beit Hashem, ve'et Beit HaMelech, God's house and his own house, ve'et kol cheshek Shlomo asher chafetz la'asot, and all the other things that he desired to do. He's got another 16 years to be king. What does one do when one has, you know, accomplished everything one wants to accomplish at a fairly young age, right? Barack Obama, I think, was the youngest president ever elected in the United States, or one of the youngest, or the youngest in 100 years, or something like that. So somebody, I remember when he became president, someone said, what do you do when you're like He wasn't even 50 when he became president. I think he was 47 or something.
How old was Kennedy?
Kennedy was a close.
Okay, but Kennedy didn't have this dilemma, because the dilemma was, what do you do when you're 52 years old and you've already been president of the United States? Like, what else is there to do?
Unfortunately, Kennedy didn't.
Right, didn't have that dilemma. So this is an interesting concept here. Now, and especially if we put Shlomo on the back of his father David. David's life, with all of its ups and downs, and all of his successes and his own failures and redemption from those failures, David's life is one of constant struggle and one of constant dreaming. Right? From the young shepherd who was, as Hashem himself said, Ani lekachticha me'acharei hatzon, who was plucked from behind the sheep and thrust into greatness, the musician, the poet, the dreamer, the many, many years on the run, having been first being chased by Shaul, eventually becoming king in Hebron, in a lengthy struggle to win the minds and hearts of the people, and then to capture Yerushalayim, and to build this. And the dream of it all was a Beit HaMikdash that he wasn't going to see in his lifetime. Right? And the Tehillim that he wrote, and the visions that he expressed, David was a dreamer, David was a visionary, and he's a person whose entire life was struggling, building towards something that he was able to see much progress towards over the course of his life. We read his speech at the end of his life as presented in Dever HaYamim, how satisfied he was on the one hand with how much he had accomplished and what a recognition he had that the work was not over and it has to be continued. And Shlomo arises to the throne on that background, and he has a lot of work ahead of him. The first few parakim of Malachim Aleph discuss how he had some very unpleasant work to do, dealing with his enemies, or some unfinished business from his father's time, and executing people, and dealing with potential rebellions. He takes care of all that, and then he begins these grandiose projects. And it takes 20 years, and he puts the Beit HaMikdash first, and he has this elaborate ceremony, and he prays to God, and fire comes down from Shemayim, and all those things happen. And then he goes on, and he builds more things. Another 13 years. And now here he is, 24 years into his reign, still a young man. We pointed out that he may have been very young when he became king, different opinions. Still a young man. And he's already done Kol Cheshek Shlomo Asher Chafetz Lasot. He's already done all that he desired to do. And this presents a dilemma. Because sometimes, and there's some famous quote that evades me, maybe one of you will recognize, but something about how there's actually a number of famous quotes like this. Oftentimes striving for something, dreaming about something, is a lot easier than accomplishing it. And once you have reached your goal, or maybe that's not even the right way to say it, once you have gotten to you've been struggling to get to a certain point to establish certain parameters so that you can accomplish your goal, once you actually get there, sometimes things get a lot more difficult, right? Because the goal wasn't to build all these things. The goal was to build all these things. All of this was, and we're going to see today, trying to understand what exactly Shlomo was trying to accomplish with all of this. The goal, on the one hand, he's completed a kol cheshek Shlomo, the kol asher chafetz lasot, everything he desired and wanted to do. On the other hand, the real test begins now. Now you've accomplished all this, now let's see you make it into that which it was supposed to be. And it's at that moment that God appears to Shlomo a second time, and this is what he says, Pasuk Bet Vayera Adonai El Shlomo Shenit Kasher Niraila BeGivon. God appeared to him a second time, just as he had appeared to him in Givon. And the Tanakh is drawing attention, we'll see a Pasuk later on at the end of Shlomo's life, that also draws attention to these two moments, as key moments in his life when God had revealed himself directly to Shlomo. And this is what he said to him. Vayomer Adonai Elav shamati et tfilatcha v'tchinatcha asher itchananta lefanai hikdashti et habayit hazeh asher banita lasum shmi sham ad olam v'heyu einai v'libi sham kol hayamim. He said, I heard the tefillah that you said at the dedication of the Beit HaMikdash 13 years ago. I heard that tefillah. And you asked that I should dwell in that house forever, permanently, and that I would always be hearing the tefillot that were said in that house. I have done that. I'm declaring that I have sanctified this house forever. Lasum shmi sham ad olam. My presence shall dwell there permanently forever. Vahayu einai v'libi sham kol hayamim. And I, God says, will always be in that spot. However, that doesn't mean that you will always be in that spot. I've done what you asked. I've come down into the house and I showed it to everybody in a dramatic thing with fire coming down from heaven and a cloud that filled the Beit HaMikdash so that the Kohanim couldn't get in there, exactly as happened hundreds of years ago in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu in the desert. And I am there and I'm not leaving. But the question of whether you'll be able to stay, that is completely up to you. You, not in the singular, but you in the plural. First you in the singular, Vata. Im telech lefanai, kasher halach David avicha, bitom levav uviyosher, vasot kichol asher tziviticha, chukai umishpatai tishmor. If you do like your father David did, and follow me with all of your heart and soul, and again, it doesn't mean that David didn't sin. We know that David did sin, and was punished deeply for it. But that's exactly the point. David, as we saw last year, took responsibility and did tshuva, and he's described here as someone who followed God with all of his heart and soul. If you do that also, Vakimoti et kisei mamlechta Yisrael leolam, kasher dibarti al David avicha lemor, lo yikaret lechayish me'al kisei Yisrael, then you and your descendants will sit on this throne here as well, forever. And as my presence in this city is eternal, your presence, Shlomo, as the father or the next in the line of the Malchut Beit David, of the eternal dynasty of the Jewish people, there will always be one of your descendants sitting upon this throne in this city as well. You can be here eternally also. But, im shov tishuvun atem uvnechem me'acharai, if you turn away from me, you or your children, your descendants, v'lo tishmeru mitzvotai v'chukotai shenatati lefnechem, if you don't follow the laws that I gave you, v'alachtem v'avadatem Elohim acherim v'shtachavitam lahem, and if instead you turn and worship foreign gods, then v'hichrati et Yisrael me'al pnei ha'adama shenatati lahem. Ve'et habayet asher hikdashti l'shmi ashalach me'al panai, v'yal Yisrael mashal l'shnina b'chol amim. Then I will remove Yisrael from this land, and I will destroy this house that you built. The churban of the mikdash, that tragically, the rest of the book of Malachim describes the gradual descent, and the book ends with the destruction of that house that Shlomo built. It's prophesied already here. Not this, it's not prophesied as a guarantee, as a definite event, but as a potential event. And if that happens, and there's also an anticipation of what others are going to later say. But what is it going to mean if God's house is destroyed? Perhaps that will mean that the God who dwelt in that house was defeated. According to the rabbis, there are all sorts of midrashim about the Babylonian officers, you know, barging into the Kodesh HaKodashim and slicing through the parochet and destroying and believing that they had defeated the God that dwelled in that house. Or perhaps, if we go to the second Beit HaMikdash, the house that, of course, was destroyed at the end of the Book of Malachim, was then rebuilt, and it went through another period of several hundred years of development and reached great heights, and was also eventually destroyed. And when the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed by the Romans, there will be those, I'm referring here to the Christians, who will interpret that event a little differently. Not like the Babylonians did, that the destruction of the house means that the God who dwelled in that house was defeated, but that the destruction of the house and the banishment of the people who built it means that those people were rejected. Right? That was the Christian claim later. Right? That God is eternal. But because Yisrael abandoned him, so he abandoned them. And the holiness that was in the temple went somewhere else. And, you know, of course, the historical juxtaposition of the birth of the founder of Christianity within the same century, roughly, as the destruction of the temple, right? He was killed about 25 years before the destruction of the temple. So all those things, you know, later Christian theology developed a whole understanding of, right? Both of those two ideas, that the destruction of the temple means that the God who dwells there is defeated or destroyed, or that it means that the people who built it are defeated or abandoned. Those are both anticipated and rejected right here in God's vision to Shlomo hundreds of years earlier.
Well, the second one is...
Let's finish reading. Watch. So what does it mean when you sin and you and I destroy this house? So what is that going to mean? V'chrati et Yisrael me'al p'nei ha'adamah she'natati lahem. I'm going to banish them from the land. V'tabayet asher hekdashti l'shmi ashalach me'al panai. V'aya Yisrael mashal l'shnina b'chol ha'amim. Am Yisrael is going to then be a source of derision. They're going to be mocked by all the nations. V'habayit hazeh yihyeh elyon. But this house, which will be at that point in ruins, this house will still rise above everything. Kol over alav yisom v'sarak v'amru al me'a sa'adonai kacha la'aretz hazot v'labayit hazeh. People will see the mikdash in ruins and they'll say, why did God do that? Why did he destroy this land? V'amru al asher azvu et Adonai Eloheihem asher hotzi et avotam me'eretz Mitzrayim v'yachziku b'elohim acherim v'yishtachavu lehem v'yavdum al kein hevi Adonai Eloheihem et kol ha'ra'ah hazot. And they'll say it's because of what they did, because they didn't follow his covenant, so he destroyed this temple and he destroyed the land. But it doesn't say he'll abandon the temple. The opposite. His presence remains there. And the house that once stood as a sign of the glory of Am Yisrael, it will remain in a state of destruction as a sign of the punishment, but not abandonment. And how do I know it's not abandonment? Here I have to fill in what's not stated here explicitly, but stated elsewhere, and I think is implied here. The land remains in ruins. It's not after. And this is stated explicitly, for example, in the book of Dvarim, and in the book of Vayikra, in the Tochacha. And history showed it to be true. The land will lay in ruins for thousands of years. People will come, conquerors will come and go. They'll build great structures there. Churches and mosques and all sorts of things. The people that lived in this land will be scattered and kicked around the earth, but the land will remain a swamp and in ruins, basically a wasteland for close to 2,000 years, 1,800, 1,900 years, where nothing really happened here until the Jews came back. Right? Correct. Correct. So, but, and that's what we spoke about already a few classes ago when we talked about the idea of the mirror and the window, the window and the mirror. Right, the Mikdash. God said to Shlomo, you ask me to dwell in this house forever, I will dwell in this house forever. And when this house is destroyed, I'm still dwelling in the house. And the holiness is still there. And the state of the house and the state of the land and the state of the people are going to reflect one thing only, your behavior. The eternal bond between me and you is there and can never be broken. And the eternal presence of my holy presence, the Shekhinah, on this spot also can never be broken. But that doesn't mean that everything is guaranteed. Nothing is guaranteed. Other than the eternity of the Jewish people. The Jewish people's eternity is guaranteed, but that doesn't mean things are going to be easy. It could be eternal suffering. It's all dependent on you. And with that message, the Tanakh, the Navi, then goes and sort of picks up on, continuing the story that was being told before this lengthy discussion in the Mikdash, and returns to Shlomo's other secular pursuits. And that takes the rest of Perek Tet and Perek Yud, and I want to read those with you now, or at least read some of them and perhaps skim through the rest. So now we're returning to Shlomo HaMelech, the secular ruler, the emperor, the politician, the military leader, the economic leader. And what does he do? So the first thing the Tanakh tells us here, and perhaps we're going to return to topics that we've already seen at least brief discussions of, and it's an open question to what extent what was said earlier and what was said now represent perhaps different phases. That was discussing an earlier phase, perhaps during or before the construction of the Beit HaMikdash and this afterwards, or perhaps really it's some of the same events being told again or told slightly differently. But at least on the literary level, and there is definitely a parallelism between the Prakim before the Mikdash and the Prakim after, and there's also, I think, a sense of development. One other comment that I meant to make at the beginning, I'll just say now, we've talked a number of times about how the 11 chapters that describe Shlomo are divided into 10 and 1, Right? And the first 10, when you read them at least on the surface, make it look like everything was wonderful and idyllic and almost utopian. And the 11th chapter, which we'll learn, God willing, next week, makes it seem as everything suddenly collapsed into total implosion and self-destruction. And to me, it's very clear that that's a literary device. And we've mentioned this already as well. And that the seeds of the ultimate downfall were there and can be seen if you look carefully. But they were certainly there during the time period discussed in the first 10 chapters. And on the other hand, and therefore, although it's presented as an idyllic utopian reality that collapsed, it wasn't so idyllic or utopian. And again, if you read between the lines, and I'm deliberately not doing too much of that yet because we're going to go back and do that next week. On the one hand. And on the other hand, the downfall perhaps isn't necessarily, and we'll talk about the possibility that some of what's said in next week's chapter is perhaps an exaggeration of sorts. So there's, you know, the literary device used by the Navi, you know, trying to highlight the positive and then highlight the negative in a very, very sharp contrasting parallel needs to be understood as a literary commentary, and we need to try to look beneath that and understand the reality that that's expressing to us. So continuing with that method, although we may already today notice certain things popping out at us that are saying, hey, you know, maybe things aren't as good as they look, so perhaps we'll take brief note of them, but we're not going to focus on them. We'll focus on them next week, right? So with that, what is it telling us here? So the first few psukim here are very puzzling, actually. Very puzzling. Vayihi pasuk yud, chapter pasuk 10. Vayihi miktzei esrim shana, asher bana shlomo et shnei abatim, et beit Adonai ve beit HaMelech. So this apparently discusses the same general time frame as the revelation that took place at the end of the 20 years when he built the two houses. Chiram melech tzor. Right? We've talked about him already, the Phoenician ruler of Tzor in southern Lebanon, who was an ally both of David and of Shlomo, and provided both the materials, the very, very high quality wood that's available in Lebanon, perhaps some of the metal, the copper, and other things for the Mikdash, and equally, if not more importantly, had provided the skilled laborers. The Phoenicians were experts at certain types of construction. They were also experts at sailing the seas, at building boats, and at international commerce. And we'll see that that was very important to Shlomo as well. We'll get to that in a few minutes. And he had assisted David. He had built the palace for David, and he had assisted Shlomo in the construction of the Beit HaMikdash. Now, and assumedly, had assisted him also in the other constructions. I mean, one of the buildings was called Beit Yar HaLevanon. Right, it was definitely built with Phoenician both materials and architecture and expertise. So what happened next? Chiram melech tzor nisad Shlomo batzei arazim uvatzei roshim uvizahav l'chol chefzo. He provided Shlomo with all sorts of materials. Az yitein hamelech Shlomo l'chiram esrim ir be'eretz ha-galil. So in compensation, Shlomo gave him 20 cities in the Galil. That's very disturbing. That Shlomo would transfer to foreign...
In exchange for the gold.
What, he's selling off the land of Eretz Yisrael like it's real estate. He's transferring territory to a non-Jewish king, assumedly removing its sanctity. And all the commentators are bothered by this. And we'll return to these psukim next week and try to understand them. And that was why I gave that brief introduction to this. If we're right now looking at the positive side of things and trying to figure out what's going on here, some of the commentators do attempt to suggest that perhaps it's not what it looks like. The Malbim, for example, suggests that it can't be, that he actually transferred the cities to him. Perhaps what it might have been is that we saw earlier, and we'll talk about this a little bit more next week also, I hope, Shlomo paid for they had a business arrangement, Shlomo and Chiram. Chiram provided the wood and the materials and the labor, and Shlomo paid for it, if you recall, with agricultural products. Okay, there was apparently a very significant surplus, and the land of Israel, and he provided him grain, wheat, and barley, and other products of the land of Israel, which apparently was something that was lacking to the Phoenicians. So Sanas and the Malbim suggest that all this was an attempt to do was to make that arrangement permanent. Not that he actually transferred the cities to him, but that he signed he offered. We'll see that this never happened, never came to fruition, but that the offer was to sign some sort of a contract, so to speak, that all of the taxes paid from the agricultural products of those 20 cities and their fields would be permanently the property. Right? Now, so not that, God forbid, he transferred sovereignty over the land to them and uprooted the Jewish farmers from their homes or anything like that, but that the farmers all over the country have to pay taxes, and the taxes are in the form of a percentage of their crops. So he was going to tell him, you will have these cities in the sense of you will collect the taxes from these cities, and that'll be like a permanent arrangement in return for whatever ongoing things you're going to give me. That's how the Malbim understands it. The Radak notices that in Divrei Hayamim, the parallel pasuk in Divrei Hayamim says something quite different. It's in Divrei Hayamim Bet, Perek. Perek Chet, chapter 8, pasuk Bet. It says, "Ve'he'arim asher natan churam l'shlomo, ba'na shlomo otam ve'yoshev shamat b'nei Yisrael." It says that Chiram Melech Tzar gave cities to Shlomo, and Shlomo built those cities and settled Jewish people in them. That's the exact opposite of what it says in Melachim. So the Radak suggests that what we're dealing here with is what they call territorial exchange, and that perhaps he did actually give him cities. We know that there were pockets of pagans who remained in the land of Israel, and there were also Jews who settled in areas, and there may have been Jews settling in that lived or wanted to live in areas that were under Hiram's control, and that there were cities with Phoenicians that were under Shlomo's control. So he wanted to make a agreement, a land swap agreement, so to speak. You'll take the areas where the Phoenicians live and give me land either where Jews live or where Jews can live, and he'll settle Jews there. And that, notice what the Radak does is he takes the Pasuk in Melachim that says that Shlomo gave cities to Hiram, and the Pasuk in Divrei Hayamim that said that Hiram gave cities to Shlomo, and he doesn't view it as a contradiction, but rather that they're both true. Right? And that he gave him the cities, and then he took the land, and he built those cities, or something like that. In any case, it's a troubling Pasuk, and what's even more strange is that Hiram didn't like the idea. Vayetzei Hiram Mitzor, Pasuk Yudbet, lirot et ha'arim ashenatan lo Shlomo, velo yashru beinav. He didn't like them. Apparently Shlomo knew what he was doing. The land that he was giving them wasn't exactly the choicest real estate. Vayomer, but Hiram wasn't stupid. And this is a very interesting pasuk. Vayomer, meha'arim ha'ele asher natata li achi. Vayekra lehem Eretz Kavul ad ayom hazeh. That territory was ultimately named Eretz Kavul, which is some sort of term for bad land. He said, what are these cities you're giving me? But he calls him my brother. Brother, come on. You know, as the Israelis say, nu bemet. You know, birtzinut. You know, come on. This is what you're offering me? So, and he calls him achi, which is very interesting. So, what to do with these psukim? It's not 100% clear, but one thing that is clear is that Shlomo's alliance with Hiram remains very important to him, even though he's finished with his major building projects. Because we'll see, he's not finished completely building, and he has another reason why he wants to maintain this alliance. And in the end, it seems that he gave him something else. The next pasuk is also difficult. Vayishlach Hiram lamelech me'ave esrim kikar zahav. It sounds like it says that Hiram then sent Shlomo a huge amount of gold. It would make more sense that Shlomo sent Hiram a lot of gold. You know, he said, okay, you don't want the cities? Fine, so I'll compensate you a different way, and how about I'll give you a lot of gold? And there are some who read the pasuk that way, even though it requires sort of playing with the grammar and the words a little bit. Others assume that obviously Shlomo gave Hiram something else, and the fact that Hiram then continued to transfer gold to Shlomo.
I don't know if the land was land that was really not good. People didn't visit it. They say it was sandy. It was, that why would he give him gold for such a land?
No, so that's exactly the point. So it must be that in the end he gave him something else. Meaning, however you read, it's a difficult pasuk, but whatever it means, it certainly means that the alliance between Shlomo and Hiram continued. You know, so either it's, you know, you have to play with the words, and it's that Shlomo gave Hiram the gold, or that Shlomo must have given him something else because he continued to supply Shlomo with gold.
But would they eventually be able to build on this land? But at this point,
well, there were 20 cities there, so wherever it was. It's not a place that's uninhabitable. It's just not the choicest of land. Those cities, you know, the sandy soil is probably not, you know, it's probably not so good for agriculture.
It was sandy, it was marshy. They said that there was one, when they spoke about the pusik, they said that your feet sank. And
yes.
To walk there, it was very difficult.
Right.
So some kind of
But apparently, if there were 20 cities there, people were living
in
it.
So, maybe it's a generalization. Maybe not all of them were this bad.
Listen. We have this. Here again, I'll tell you from things I've seen over the last 6 months. You know, if you go to, for example, the swamps that the Israelis drained, or the Zionists before Israel, right? When we came back to this land, like you were saying, the land was a wasteland, and we all know the Zionist myths and legends that they're true about how they drain the swamps. Some of those places we're now realizing it was a terrible mistake to drain the swamps and ruined to cause all kinds of reversing it again, right? But take for example Emek Yisrael, the Jezreel Valley, which is one of the places where one of the reasons why the early Zionist settlement groups settled in the places they settled is they decided to go for places which weren't heavily settled with Arabs, right? So, for example, Emek Yisrael, where a lot of the early settlements, you know, the late 19th century and early 20th century, the early kibbutzim, a lot of them were in that area, because the land was not really very inhabitable, and therefore, you know, they came and they drained the swamps and they settled there. But that doesn't mean there was nobody there. There are Arab villages there. There were some farms there. There weren't anywhere near as many as there were up in the mountains in Shomron and Har Yehuda, where the land was much better.
It wasn't prime land.
Right.
That's
right. Exactly. Okay. But it wasn't completely uninhabited or uninhabitable.
It sounds like Hiram really wanted to keep the relationship alive. That's what I got.
Sounds like they both did. Like you know, any international relations, you know. And I assume in business also, you know, relationships continue precisely as long as they're in the interest of both sides. Right? Someone said nations have no values, only interests, or something like that. That's some famous, right? So one thing we see from this is that the relationship with Hiram, you're right, certainly it was of benefit to Hiram, but it seems to have also been important to Shlomo as well. Okay, let's see what else we see here. V'zed dvar hamas asher halah ha-melech Shlomo livnot et beit Adonai ve'et beito ve'et hamilo ve'et chomat Yerushalayim ve'et chatzor ve'et megido ve'et gazer. Okay, it discusses here a list of cities and building projects that Shlomo engaged in. And it happens to be that we have archaeological remains today of every single one of these.
Wow.
Every single one of these
really?
Projects. It says that he built chomat Yerushalayim. Now, he built the wall of Yerushalayim. Now, Yerushalayim already had a wall. Even before David, Yerushalayim had a wall. You can see it, first of all. The ancient Canaanite wall has been excavated, and the Tanakh discusses it. So why did Shlomo have to build the wall of Yerushalayim? The answer is clearly because he expanded the city. The area where he built the Beit HaMikdash, and presumably where he built his whole palace complex, had been outside the city. So there was no wall there. So he had to build a wall around that part of the city. And in fact, just a few years ago, the archaeologist Eilat Mazar, the same archaeologist who's done a lot of work in Ir David, she did a dig at the south of the Har HaBayit, if you're familiar with the excavations there, what's called the Ophel area. And she uncovered remains from the first Beit HaMikdash time. And she uncovered a section of a wall and a city gate that she identified with the time of Shlomo. And if you go there, you can see it. Even you don't even have to pay admission. If you walk, because it's near the edge of the archaeological park. So if you walk out of, like, if you're at the Kotel and you walk out of Shar Hashbot, you make a left, right, walking outside the walls. Like in the same direction as Ir David, but don't make the right turn and go down the hill to Ir David. Just keep walking along the outside of the wall of the old city, and you'll get to the area of the archaeological excavations that were there. So there's a place that maybe 150 meters down from Shaar HaShemesh, there's a little indentation in the wall and a little where you can stand on the sidewalk and look into the archaeological park because it's right there, and there's a little sign, and it quotes this pasuk, I believe. No, it quotes a pasuk earlier, but from this, from Lachim, you know, about the things that Shlomo built.
Cool.
Fascinatingly, Chatzor and Megiddo and Gezer, okay, three cities that it says here Shlomo built. Chatzor is all the way in the north in the Galil Elyon. There's a city named Chatzor Glilit there today. Megiddo is in Emek Israel, not far from, let's say, Afula. And Gezer is down here. Gezer is near Latrun. Okay? Not far from Lod, Ramla, south of Modi'in. So it says here that these three cities were built by Shlomo. These are three cities in three districts of the country, all on major intersections, three strategic cities. It says that Shlomo built these three cities. And the archaeologist Yigael Yadin in the 1960s found in each of these cities identical walls and city gates that are all visible today, and that he dated to the time of Shlomo. So it's just amazing, right? The Tanakh says that Shlomo built these three cities, and you have the exact same architecture. It's clear that the same, like they say today, you know, the same engineer, the same Kabbalan, you know, built them. And exactly, like you could see it with your eyes, the architecture of the city gates there.
Is that they identify it by the gate, the structure of the gate?
Well, that's
pretty much.
Well, that's how you can see that these three were built in the same style. Now, there's the gate and the wall. It's a certain type of wall. It's called a casemate wall, whatever. Two walls with intervening rooms. And then the style of the gate, there are four chambers on each side of the gate, and there's a drainage channel, whatever. It was clearly designed by the same, you know, according to the same exact style. Whatever, there's a major debate now in the archaeological community. There's a professor from Tel Aviv, who you may have heard of, Yisrael Finkelstein, who has been arguing vociferously that David and Shlomo either didn't really exist, or if they did exist, that they there was no kingdom, there was just like some local thing here in Yerushalayim, and he claims that all those structures were from a much later period. But one of the biggest problems with that argument specifically about these three cities is that he claims they were built by Achav much later on. Achav could have built Chatzor and Megiddo. It's very difficult to think that Achav would have built Gezer, because Gezer was in the territory of, was not in his territory. It was in the territory of Judah. So you could say, well, so they still use the same architect or whatever, the same architectural style, but, you know, that, you know. So in any case, he builds these cities. Now, these cities are at these major intersections, so there's a strategic military component to it as well. And Gezer wasn't in his hands originally. Look how he got Gezer. Pasuk Tet Zayin. Paro Melech Mitzrayim Ala Vayilkod Et Gezer Vayisrifa Ba'esh Ve'et HaKena'ani HaYoshev Ba'ir Harag Vayitna Shiluchim Levito Eshet Shlomo. Apparently, even David hadn't captured Gezer. Gezer was a Canaanite enclave. And Paro Melech Mitzrayim came and conquered Gezer, burnt it to the ground, killed the Canaanim that were there, and handed it over to Shlomo as the dowry for his daughter. Her daughter Bat Paro, that Shlomo married. We'll see that she comes back up again here as well. And you can see, by the way, remains of that in Gezer also. There's an ancient Canaanite city there, with a city wall there, and there's a destruction layer, if I remember correctly, there. And then you see the wall that was later built by Shlomo when he rebuilt the city. You can see this all with your eyes at Tel Gezer. Paro, now Gezer's a strategic value to Paro as well. It's on the main road, the Derech Hayam, the what was later called the Via Maris, the road, the sea route, the route that travels, you know, near the Mediterranean coast from Egypt, and heads north towards Megiddo, and then cuts across Emek Yisrael and heads out towards Mesopotamia, Syria, Damascus, and then later on Mesopotamia. So for an Egyptian king to want to conquer Gezer makes sense. It's a forward position for him. And at earlier points in history, when the Egyptians basically ruled the land of Israel, they would have wanted a place like that. At this point, Paro conquers it and gives it, you know, it doesn't actually say that he gave it to Shlomo. Who did he give it to?
To his daughter.
To his daughter, the wife of Shlomo.
Did he conquer it at that time, or had he conquered it previously?
It sounds like he conquered it at this time. But it seems that this is part of the arrangement, right? This is, you know, it's not just a wedding gift, right? And it's not, on the one hand, the word shiluchim is a word that implies a dowry. Now, with the girl comes the city, something like that. You know, ordinary people's dowry would be paid in cash or in clothing and stuff like that. When you marry the daughter of a, when you marry a princess, so the dowry includes a city.
not bad,
right? But it's also important the way this is written. You know, it was given to Bat Paro. In other words, it's not 100% clear to what extent she was subservient to Shlomo. And it was a political marriage in the sense of take my daughter and, you know, whatever, and that here I'm giving this to you and you're the ruler of the land and you're the ruler of the city. Or to what extent there was some sort of power-sharing arrangement here, and perhaps she had some autonomy, and perhaps this was, you know, sort of an area that had some Egyptian control. On the other hand, we have Shlomo's, again, this is a great example where archaeology can help you understand the Tanakh, and the two can go together. We have, if I saw their Egyptian architecture, right, in the city, then I would say, look what happened. Shlomo, you know, basically enabled an Egyptian forward position in his territory. I don't see that. I see a gate there that's identical to the gates that Shlomo built in Megiddo and in Chatzor, on the one hand. On the other hand, let's see how the Tanakh describes the relationship with Bat Paro. So we'll get to that in a minute. But again, clearly his relationship with Hiram Melech Tzor is important to him. His relationship with Paro Melech Mitzrayim is important to him as well. There's a list here of other cities that he conquered. Tamar Bamidbar, we may know where that is also. I was there also a number of months ago, but maybe we'll just skip a little bit. Yeah, let's skip a little bit because I want to make sure to get to some other things. One second. Yeah, in Pasuk Chav Dalet here, it says, Ach bat paro, alta meir David el beita asher banala, az bana tamilo. Shlomo built a house, a separate house for Bat Paro. And we'll see that he had 1,000 wives. Assuming they didn't each get a house. Right. Assumedly they didn't each get a house. Bat Paro clearly had a separate status. Shlomo built her a palace just for her. And it says that she went up. She went up from Ir David. Now, in other words, it's part of this whole massive complex government buildings that he built. He built his, near the Beit HaMikdash, he built his palace. And he built the Beit Yara Levanon. Now again, David's palace was still standing, and assumedly it was then used for other things. Maybe that's where many of the other wives lived. It became part of the government building, but there was a separate structure, a palace, just for Bat Paro. But look at the language that's used here. Az alta paro, Bat Paro. She went up, Meir David, el beita asher banala. It doesn't say what it does in Divrei Hayamim. In Divrei Hayamim it says, again, it's in Perek Chet. It says, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Ve'et Bat Paro He'ela Shlomo Meir David V'vayet Asher Banala. Ki Amar Lo Teshev Ishali Be'Beit David Melech Yisrael Ki Kodeshema. He gave a reason why he doesn't want her to live in the house of David. So he built her house and he brought her up and put her there. That's the way it presents in Divrei Hayamim. But here in Malachim it says that she went up herself. In other words, there's a question here as to how much the city that her father conquered, he gave to her as a dowry, but he gave it to her. And Shlomo builds her a separate palace, and she goes up into that palace. And it's not 100% clear to what extent Shlomo has sovereignty, has control over her. And again, I'm not talking about a husband-wife relationship where the husband dominates the wife or something like that. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about Shlomo as the king of Israel and she as the princess of Egypt that married him. To what extent that political marriage is one in which whatever she represents is subservient to Shlomo, and to what extent she represents an Egyptian foothold in the land, perhaps with some degree of autonomy. She has her own palace, and perhaps she's collecting, if she owns, we talked about the idea that Hiram maybe owns those cities in the sense that he collects the taxes. Who collects the tax money from Gezer? Does it go straight to her? Is she running her own apparatus there? Right? Is there an Egyptian, and that's a question in terms of the political, geopolitical, military, economic relationship that's going on here.
Well, when did he build Gezer?
Just half a second. But it's also a question, and here again we're moving up towards next week's shiur here, about what level of cultural autonomy she has, and to what extent there is aspects of Egyptian culture, Zotomeret, pagan culture, that are here. Yeah, I'm sorry, what do you want to say?
So what are we saying? Because at the beginning it said he built these three cities, Gezer. I'm just chronologically, I'm trying to figure this out. And then Pharaoh came, destroyed that city?
It says it in that order.
Right.
But obviously that's not the order in which it happened.
Right.
And here again, archaeology makes this very clear. If you go to Gezer, you can see this with your own eyes.
Right.
There was a Canaanite city that predates Shlomo by hundreds of years. It existed. Okay, that city was destroyed.
Yeah.
And then there's a later wall and gate that's built by Shlomo.
Exactly.
Okay, so the way you have to read this pasuk is Shlomo built Chatzor, Megiddo, and Gezer. Mm-hmm. Parenthetically, the Tanakh says, oh, by the way, mm-hmm. how did he get Gezer? Mm-hmm. Gezer he got because Paro had conquered it and gave it to him. But what did he give him? He gave him a city that was in ruins.
Right.
Meaning he destroyed the Canaanite city.
Right.
Burnt it down. Killed all the people that were there and said, here you go. So then Shlomo then brought people from his people, settled the city, and built a new city there.
Uh-huh.
And the city he built there, again, you could see the archaeology. It matches the archaeology in Megiddo and Chatzor.
An insurance policy on Paro's part that he would have the trade routes going through all the time.
Exactly, exactly. It's clear that the marriage to Bat Paro was a political marriage. What's unclear is to what extent, you know, what the balance of power is in that relationship. In other words, certainly preserving, it's a trade route, it's also a potential military route. Anyone who wants to attack
has to come that way.
And don't forget that Shlomo's kingdom, today we think of that as deep in the heart of the land of the state of Israel, but Shlomo's kingdom is further east, right? There's the Philistine territory still to the west of there. In other words, Gezer is an outpost in Shlomo's kingdom. Right? It's not deep in the heart of Eretz Yehuda. And it's on a main road between Yehuda and between the Plishtim, on a main road, you know. So it's of great strategic significance, thank you, for the Egyptians. But like I said, on the other hand, and reading these psukim, I might have almost thought that like it's not clear how much sovereignty Shlomo has there. But we don't have Egyptian architecture there; we have Shlomo architecture there. So that says something too, right? Okay. And we have other archaeological remains that make it clear that there were Bnei Israel living in that city. It was not there were no Egyptians living there. There were no Philistines living there. It was a Jewish city. Hebrew writing and all sorts of other things. Now, in Pasuk Chavav, we also read about a port city that Shlomo built in Eilat. Va'ani, ani from the word oniyot, ships, a fleet of ships. Asa ha-melech Shlomo be'etzion gever asher et Eilot, al sfat yam suf be'eretz Edom. Okay, so that's the city of Eilat, or actually in today's terms, biblical Eilat is the Jordanian city of Aqaba today. What we call Eilat today was uninhabited. It's called Eilat because it's right near Eilat, the biblical Eilat. But it's on the same place. It's there on the on the shores of the Red Sea. Now, on the one hand, you have to understand that this is many, many, many hundreds of kilometers outside of the land, the settled land of Israel. The biblical borders, we've seen the pasuk already in our section here, Midan ve'ad Be'er Sheva. Okay, Be'er Sheva is, 150 kilometers or something like that, north of Eilat. And in between, there is a desert. A desert that at that time was almost completely uninhabited. A very, very, very large desert which means that when Shlomo goes there, he's going far away. This is an outpost. This is not a settled area at all. And why? Why is he going there? He's going there because from there you have trade routes open to an entire part of the world, to Africa and to the east. There's no Suez Canal in those days, right? You have trade routes from there to Arabia, Yemen, etc., and further east to India, correct? And we'll see that that's exactly what he was, this is done together with Hiram. So now you want to talk about what this relationship is. Why does Hiram want it? Hiram wants it because the Phoenicians are seafarers, right? They have trade routes going from the Lebanese coast to Europe. Okay, they have no way to get, though, by boat to the east. They have no way to get by boat to the east. For that, they need Shlomo. But Shlomo needs them because they know how to build boats and they know how to sail the boats. Okay, so this is a mutually beneficial relationship. And it says that he did it, that they did it together. Vayishlach Hiram ba'oni et avadav anshei oniyot yodei hayam. Im avdeshlomo, he sent his expert sailors to go there and work together with sailors from Shlomo's fleet. Not unlike today when, countries will bring in experts from other countries, to help them. Right? And we have today, Israel, we have experts, we've developed all kinds of agricultural techniques. We send people around the world and, developing countries will bring in Israeli experts to help them with their agriculture and they'll send us experts who are, whatever they can do and, etc. Vayavo Ophira, they went to Ophir, which seems to be perhaps somewhere in Yemen or further east in India, a place where there was gold. Vayichumi Sham Zahav, and they brought gold. Okay, so this was an economic venture. And now we get to the famous Malkat Shva, the famous queen of Sheba. Where is Sheba? Shva, it also seems to be in Yemen. Some say Ethiopia, the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula. And there's this queen who rules there. Umalkat Shva shomat et shema Shlomo l'shem Adonai v'tavol nasoto b'chidot. She heard that he's very, very wise. She comes to, she's going to ask him all kinds of riddles to test his wisdom. She came herself, the queen herself, with this large entourage. Gmalim nosim b'samim v'zahav rav me'od ve'evin yikara, coming with all sorts of riches and exotic things that she either were available in her land or in the areas that she had access to, right from Yemen. Things that may have come from further east, from the spices of India, for example, gold which may have come from mines in Africa. Evan Yikara, all sorts of precious gems, maybe diamonds even. Vatavoel Shlomo, v'tadaver elav et kol asher hayah l'levavah. They had this lengthy conversation. Vayaged la Shlomo et kol dvareha. Whatever she asked him, he answered all of her questions, answered all of her riddles. Lo haya davar ne'alam min ha'melech asher lo yigid la. Vatere malkat shva et kol chochmat Shlomo. She saw his wisdom. V'abayit asher bana. She saw this incredible building projects that he had done. U'ma'achal shulchano u'moshav avadav u'ma'amad mishartav u'malbusheihem u'mashkav. She saw, they didn't serve pizza. They had a major, he treated her to royal banquets, etc. And she saw all the wealth and all the opulence and the expensive clothing that even the servants were wearing. And she saw also the Beit HaMikdash. He brought her to the Beit HaMikdash. She saw the korbanot that were being brought there. VIP treatment, right? She was blown away. Batomer el HaMelech. Now, by the way, it does not say what common legend says, which is that he married her. It doesn't say that at all. We're going to see she goes home afterwards. The idea that they got married by people, I guess it's
made
partially
a good movie.
Yeah, I guess it's partially fueled by the idea that we know he had all these foreign wives, 1,000 of them, and she features so prominently. So I guess people just got confused. There are some legends in non-Jewish sources that in Ethiopia and in other places there are these legends that they were married, but that does not appear in the Torah, in the Tanakh at all. There are some late Jewish sources, including the Arizal, who discussed not a marriage, but an illegitimate child born between the two of them. There's a comment that somehow wound up in, it's not Rashi, because it's attributed to the Ari, but it somehow got put into the manuscripts of Rashi. If you open up Rashi and this pasuk in parentheses in the standard printing, it says that some later person put in this quote from the Ari that they spent a night together, Shlomo and the Queen of Sheba, and she had a child from that encounter who became an ancestor of Nebuchadnezzar, who destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. And that's a very, very fascinating midrashic twist, on the story. But that's not what it says here. It says here that she came and she was, extremely impressed. She said, everything I heard in my land, it's all true. Al dvarecha v'al chochmatecha, b'lo he'emanti ladvarim ad asher bati v'tirena inai. I didn't believe it until I saw it. V'nei lo hugad li hachetzi. And now I realize that what they told me, I didn't believe it would be true. Now I see they didn't even tell me half of what's true. Hosafta chochma v'tov al hashmua asher shamati. Ashrei anashecha, ashrei avadecha, ele ha'omdim lefanecha tamid, hashomim et chochmatecha. Praiseworthy are you, praiseworthy are all of your servants, and even more importantly, Yehi Adonai Elohecha Baruch, Asher Chafetz Becha, Letitcha Al Kisei Yisrael, Be'avat Adonai Et Yisrael Yolam, Vayisimcha Lemelech Lasot Mishpat Utzdaka. And she blesses God, praises God, just like Shlomo had said when he built the Beit HaMikdash, he spoke about Hanochri Asher Lo Me'amcha Yisrael Hi, who? He spoke about a foreigner from a foreign land who's going to come to see. And here obviously when she went to Beit HaMikdash, he accompanied her personally, right? This is a foreign dignitary. This is not the foreign minister of some country or lower level dignitary. This is the queen. Yeah. You could see the VIP tour here, and he's taking her to Beit HaMikdash himself. And she praises God exactly like he said. This is what this is supposed to happen. Now, to what extent was this sincere, and to what extent was this also part of a political arrangement? It's clear that there was an economic trade agreement between them. Look what she gave Shlomo. She gave him lots and lots of gold and spices, and gems. Lo va kabosem ahu od larov, asher natnal makat shva lamelech Shlomo. She gave him spices and perfumes that were unparalleled in the world at this time. Did I ever talk? Did we mention here the Shemen Afar Simon? Did I talk about that at some point? Mm-hmm. There's this plant that was grown much later on in history, in the time of Beit Sheni, in the area of Yam HaMelech, that was extremely, extremely valuable. In Herodian times, and afterwards, they made a perfume from it. It was only the only people who knew how to grow it and produce this oil from it were Jewish farmers in the area of Yam HaMelech, in Gedi and Yericho and places like that. According to some ancient sources, the price for this perfume was an equivalent weight of gold. And it was 100 grams of the perfume sold for 100 grams of gold. And we don't know exactly what it was now. I just met this farmer, actually, that thinks he knows what it is and is trying to bring it back. And a guy in a kibbutz down there, kibbutz Almog. But anyway, Josephus claims that that was the plant that she... That's what this is. That's how we got it. Because the plant that they think it is has its origins in Arabia. Mm-hmm. So they said, Josephus says that she brought this plant, and that's one of the things she gave him. That's what this pasuk is talking about. And then it was later planted and developed by Jewish farmers. But there are many... The contemporary researchers don't think that makes sense because they think it was here earlier. But anyway, clearly there's exchange of merchandise here. V'gam et chiram asher nasa zahav mi ofir hevi mi ofir atzei al mugim. So it talks here about you know, she entered into she presented gifts to Shlomo and also to his ally Hiram, and there's this trade going right. So he has now this ally in the north and this ally in the south, and there's this exchange of merchandise and of goods, and he uses this stuff. She brought him atzei almugim, some kind of wood, that some kind of exotic wood, and he used it to build misad leveit Hashem uleveit Hamelech. He used it in some of the construction in the Beit HaMikdash and in the palace, and for some of the instruments that the Levim played in the Beit HaMikdash, it seems. Let's just skip a little further down. Pasuk Yud Chet, Vayaz HaMelech Kisei Shein Gadol. Shein is tooth ivory. Okay, he made a throne made out of ivory, and again, ivory comes from Africa. Okay, so again, this is a result of these trade roots that he opened up with the poor Dine Lot and with his alliance with the Queen of Shva and with Ophir. It's not clear exactly which of these particular things, but he's got this interest. He's developing these trade routes to the south and to the east, and he brings ivory, very, very expensive material from Africa, and he makes a throne out of it. By Tzapeu Zahav, made out of ivory, plated in gold. Sheish Ma'alot Lakisei, six steps going up to the throne. Verosh Agol Lakisei Me'acharav. V'yadot mizeh umizeh makom hashavet u'shnayim arayot omdim etzel hayadot u'shnei masar ariyim omdim shama al shnei sheish malot mizeh umizeh lo nasechin l'chol ha'mamlechot. Very elaborate description of lions and all kinds of symbolism that's on this throne. And there's much commentary on trying to understand what the symbolism of all this is. There's parallels to Yechezkel's vision and possible mystical things here, and parallels to things he did in the Beit HaMikdash. He's also building on his own throne here. Again, that juxtaposition that we saw last week with the palace and the Beit HaMikdash sort of, you know, being juxtaposed one with the other. And he's able to do this, of course, because he has these exotic materials and these extremely, extremely expensive materials. V'choklei mashkei ha-melech Shlomo Zahav, the tableware at his palace was made out of pure gold. I believe the Queen of England also has gold silverware that they use at some point or another. I remember reading, where did I read this? I read something about this from the, I was reading from once something from the chief rabbinate, the London Besdin's Kashrus division. They have something, I forgot what this was exactly, but they made an exception to a policy that they normally have. Something about when the Queen hosted Shimon Peres, they wanted kosher food, but they wanted to use the royal tableware, which is made of solid gold, or something like that.
Maybe it's gold plate.
No, gold is light, isn't it?
Yeah, gold is heavy.
Gold is heavy.
Yeah.
Maybe it was. I don't think it was silver. I think it was gold. Something about how they. No, they. Something about how they couldn't kosher it in the normal way, and you know it's halachically okay, but you know it was something that they were describing. I was looking up once because I had a kosher question, something from England, and I found this on their website. I don't remember the details, but they were talking about how they had these high standards and even things chumras that they don't need, but they did make an exception so they could give hashkacha when the Queen hosted Shimon Peres on the royal something. I don't remember exactly what, but in any case. And we know of another king in the mentioned in the Tanakh who had the hashkot beklei zahav vekelim mikelim shonim. That's Achashverosh, right? Right. Shlomo has tableware made out of gold. Ein kesef lo nechshav bimei Shlomo l'meuma. Silver was worthless in his time. We don't use silver, only gold. Ki oni tarshish l'melech bayam. Because, and this is all because of these trade routes to the south, Im Ani Hiram, because of the alliance with Hiram and the trade routes that he opened up to the south and to the east. It talks about how every 3 years that shipment of gold and silver and ivory came, and they also brought Shen Habim v'Kofim v'Tukiim, Pasuk Chafet. They brought also exotic animals. They brought elephants and monkeys and parrots. It sounds like Shlomo wanted to open a zoo. It sounds like he did open a zoo with exotic animals from Africa. Vaygdal ha-melech Shlomo mikol malchei ha-aretz la-osho le-chochma. V'chol ha-aretz mevakshim et p'nei Shlomo l'shmor chochmato she-natan elohim b'libo. What was the point of all this? Shlomo became greater in wealth and in wisdom than all the other kings in the world. And the entire Chol Ha'aretz here should be understood as all the world, or the entire region at least. Mivakshim et Pnei Shlomo, they all wanted to come. As if, you know, the visit of the Malkat Sheva is described because it's such an important visit. But there were many others like it who would come to Yerushalayim. The Hema Mevim Ish Min Chato, they would come bringing gifts, Klei Chesef, Klei Zahav, Uslamot, the Neshek, Uvisamim, Susim, Ufradim, Devar Shana, Bashana, they would bring weapons, they would bring horses, they would bring clothing to Yerushalayim. I mentioned earlier, you know, how there were a number of things my thoughts from my tour guide course, you know, came up in this parak. I actually didn't get to the thing about Masada. I'll have to mention that next week. But we talked about some of the archaeology here. But something else that I, you know, in the current mindset that I'm in, when I read these prakim, the word that popped out of my mind was tourism. That's what Shlomo wanted to create in Yerushalayim. Mm-hmm. He wanted to create a city that would become a center of tourism, where people come to the capital of the country, and there's impressive monumental buildings there. There's fancy hotels and royal banquets and good restaurants.
Zoos.
And there's a zoo. And there are libraries and museums. Yeah. And there are scholars. As other, you know, ancient capitals, again, you could see what Herod later on built here in Jerusalem. But in Herodian Jerusalem, there was a you know, just a few blocks from the Beit HaMikdash, there was a Greek theater where they had, you know, or Greek-style Roman, you know, entertainment. That wasn't Shlomo's idea, I don't think. He wanted to be the best of everything, the wealthiest city in the world, the most impressive city in the world, where the greatest scholars were, where the best university is, where there's a zoo with exotic animals from around the world, and where there's riches, and where there's all sorts of things, and in the center of it all is the Beit HaMikdash. When Malkat Sheva comes, he takes her around and he shows her, and he gives her royal banquets, and he shows her the palaces, but the centerpiece, the highlight of the visit, the one that's highlighted in the front page of the newspaper, right? In her 5-day visit here, whatever it was, you know, when she goes to this place and this place and this place and the dignitaries, but the one that gets on the prime time is when she comes to the Beit HaMikdash, and she says, Yehi Hashem Elokecha Baruch. And we have here this vision, right, and this blurring of the lines between the religious and the secular, which, like we talked about, could go in either direction, right? But it seems that the vision behind it was, right, even Shlomo's own share, right? Mystics later on found all sorts of Kabbalistic symbolism in his throne, right? Because he wants to show that his throne is really God's throne. And that's what God said to him, right? You will sit on that throne exactly as long as you and your people follow the Torah. And therefore, your sitting on that throne has to be representative of the real throne, of the real king, right? Your throne, the Beit HaMikdash, is the throne of God on this world, right? And next to it, slightly below it, is your house, palace, and all these other buildings and all this other thing around it, right? And, you know, when I talk about this, you know, when you think of tourism, right? Think about, you know, and we live in a unique time. This is really where this is all coming to. We'll talk more about this next week also. But look at Yerushalayim on Chol HaMoed, right? And see what's going on here, right? People coming from all over the world, Jews and on Sukkot, non-Jews also. We talked about that, right? And they're coming because it's a great place to go, and that's where the best hotels are and the best restaurants are, and it's fine. Right, and there's the when you come here, you go to this museum, and you go to that show, and this thing, and this thing, and here. But they're here because it's right. And then where are they all going? They're all going to today. There's no Beit HaMikdash right now yet. Right, they're going to the Kotel. Right, it's where the center of the story is. The police close off the old city to traffic for the entire week. You have this image again, right? And on the periphery, what's going on here? The people selling things, and there are street fairs and festivals, and you know, and all sorts of other things going on. And other times here, there's business conferences in Yerushalayim. That's what Shlomo wanted to create, right? It's an economic center. It's a political center. There's international trade agreements being going on here, and probably not just between him and other people. This was the United Nations. You think all these foreign dignitaries, they came here, they probably were talking to each other also, right? He wants to build, and it's right here in the center of the world where HaKadosh Baruch Hu put Eretz Yisrael, right? And he's got relationships with Egypt to the west, and he's got relationships with the countries to the south and to the east, and he's got relationships with countries in the north. And all of this is meant to bring about this situation where the Jewish people, which is living in the land of Israel, worshipping God with the Beit HaMikdash in their center, becomes a magnet for the entire world surrounding them in all directions to come here and to fulfill the mandate which was given to them back at Sinai 480 years before Shlomo built the Beit HaMikdash. V'atem tiyuli mamlechet kohanim v'goy kadosh. You shall be for me a nation of priests and a kingdom of priests and a holy nation that's meant to represent God to the world. This is what Shlomo was trying to accomplish. Next week, we'll read the next psukim and see how the whole thing, the way the Tanakh describes it, seems to have collapsed like that. We'll have to go back and see, what did go wrong, in all of that.